This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Nathaniel Philbrick writes in his new book, Bunker Hill, that in the late 18th century, Boston was known for its love of liberty, its piety, and its prostitutes. The city of 15,000 was chafing under occupation by British troops. Skirmishes at Lexington and Concord led to the bloody Battle of Bunker Hill in June of 1775. One of the heroes of that time was a man I had never heard of, Dr. Joseph Warren, who died during that battle that sparked the American Revolution. George Washington led the rebels against the British and remarked they were an exceeding dirty and nasty people. Nathaniel Philbrick joins us on Radio Times to correct some of the myths and misunderstandings about this period of history. He's a national award-winning author of narrative history. And Nathaniel Philbrick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Describe for us what Bunker Hill looks like today. Not in 1775, but today.
Well, if you've seen the movie The Town, it's largely set there. It's a hill, but it's densely settled with townhouses. But atop it is this obelisk, the granite obelisk that says Bunker Hill. But it's a little bit confusing because the Bunker Hill Monument is actually set atop a hill known as Breed's Hill. And confusion has surrounded this battle basically from the very beginning.
And do you think there's something unique about this battle that has created this confusion, even mythologies? Or do you think that sort of happens with history over time?
It does. It happens all the time, but there's certain ingredients that add to it. This was a battle that should have never happened. What the Americans were trying to do was to stall a British attack, but instead of building a fort on Bunker Hill, as they wanted to, it was Breed's Hill, and that fomented this attack. And, you know, what's added to the confusion is Americans think we won the Battle of Bunker Hill, but no, actually, it was the British who won. But, of course, the British would be the ultimate losers in the Revolution, hence some of the confusion.
Well, let's go back to Boston at this time, which you describe as a town on a tiptoe. A little town.
Yeah.
Almost an island town in a way.
Right. Well, you know, if you visited Boston, it bears almost no resemblance to the way it was in 1775. It was a 1.2 square mile island dominated by three hills of almost mountainous proportions, a little town of 15,000 people with a thin neck of land connecting it to the mainland. And it was a port, the largest port in New England, and it was oriented towards this what is a vast Boston Harbor and the ocean beyond. And so everyone was always looking out towards the sea because that's where their trade came from. That was their lifeblood. And so there were church steeples all around, and it was a town on tiptoe, always looking for, you know, the next ship.
But as you have described, this was a town known for its love of liberty, its piety, and its prostitutes. Beacon Hill, which is a very tony part of Boston, as I understand it, was known as Mount Whoredom.
Yes. You know, there was a slightly different reputation than perhaps Bostonians would prefer to have with their city today. But, you know, this was one of the points of my book, and Boston is really the hero of this book. This is about a community. And one of the things I love about Boston, pre-revolutionary Boston, was it was a community like all communities. It was filled with all sorts of kinds of people, good, bad, heroic, cowardly. You know, it was that kind of community. And this is a book about a community under stress that is turned literally inside out by a revolution.
And there were slaveholders in Boston.
I mean, and that is one of the great ironies and paradoxes of the liberty movement at this time. And this was pointed out by the African-American poet Phyllis Wheatley, that many of the patriots own slaves. Hmm. And, you know, how can you talk about liberty when you actually possess people? And so, you know, it was a movement that applied to only people like ourselves, what would become America and that sense of tolerance was yet to come.
So why don't we know about, or perhaps why don't I know about Dr. Joseph Warren?
Well, I kind of blame the city of Philadelphia, to tell you the truth.
I figured
because,
you did, right?
Because there was this Continental Congress going on, and all of the patriots from Boston that we associate with the Revolution, John Hancock, Samuel Adams, John Adams, were away from Boston during the actual breakout of the Revolution, and either in Philadelphia or on their way there. And it was left to a 33-year-old doctor Joseph Warren, a widower with four kids between the ages of 2 and 8, who became the de facto leader of the on-the-ground revolution. And he would die at Bunker Hill, and as a consequence, he's not part of the pantheon we all know today.
He didn't get to write the history, I guess, the way those others might have?
Well, you're actually in a way, because, you know, he didn't have the letters, the diaries that, you know, historians would have as a paper trail. And you really need that kind of thing to be written about in the future. And so what he left is poignant and incredibly eloquent. But his life was cut short, and he was in the midst of a time where, you know, every minute of every day things were happening. And he had an extraordinary talent to adapt to the times, to charismatically inspire people. And I think it's time we knew more about him.
Was he an eccentric? There's a description of him in a toga addressing people yeah. in Boston. You don't see that every day.
Well, no, you know, he was a guy who had a sense of the dramatic, and like many successful politicians today. He knew how to read a crowd. And this was, we've all heard of the Boston Massacre. And in the years after that, they would have an annual oration in memory of those who had died in the Boston Massacre. And on March 6th, since the 5th had been a Sunday, they had it on the 6th, just before the outbreak of Lexington and Concord. They had the Massacre Day oration in the Old South Meeting in downtown Nantucket. It was the largest venue for a speaking engagement. 5,000 people crowded in there. Everyone was armed, and by this time there were thousands of British soldiers in Boston, so it was very tense. There were about 40 officers in the church when Joseph Warren delivers this oration, and he arrives dressed in a toga. And this was a time when patriot leaders revered the classical examples. And so for those who agreed with him, it was like, oh my gosh, you know, it's like a Kiss concert, you know, where the uniform, the costume adds to it. And for those, of course, who didn't agree with him, and there were plenty,
sure.
It was a source of derision. But this was a guy who could catch your attention and hold it.
Well, and didn't he dress up for the Battle of Bunker Hill?
Well, yeah, he was a very snappy dresser, and it was just part of who he was, not unlike George Washington, who was known for his immaculate clothes, and, you know, he knew how to, you know, how to command attention. And so he goes into this, in the midst of this terrible battle that's destined to be the bloodiest battle of the Revolution. Most of the people around him are farmers who have been, you know, out there for weeks, and they're dirty, and he comes immaculately dressed like Lord Fauntleroy, he's described, and goes right into the maw of the most worst part of the battle, and isn't killed till the very end, inspiring the troops. And so, you know, he was quite a figure.
Well, and like a lot of public figures, had a mistress.
Yes, you know, he was not perfect, and he was a widower at this time, but there is evidence, and it's fairly late-breaking evidence. It was revealed by a diary of his close friend who went to Harvard with him, that who was also a doctor, and he lived in Dedham, where he had a tavern and a boarding house. And in March, just before everything breaks loose with Lexington and Concord, he remarked in this that Warren's fair incognita pregnans, a young woman, arrived, and she would be delivered. You know, we don't have solid evidence who was the father, but Warren visited her several times, and she would deliver a child just within a week of the Battle of Bunker Hill after Warren's death.
You also write about a number of the British who were, in a sense, occupying Boston at this time, including Thomas Gage. And I don't want to read too much into what you've written, but you seem to have some sympathy for some of these figures.
Absolutely. You know, I was surprised. I grew up like everyone, thinking it was black and white. You know, it was patriot liberty versus British tyranny, and there was no difference. You know, it was black or, but it wasn't. It was much more complicated than that. This was a war. It would become a war that British generals had no interest in. They were fighting their own people, and Gage embodies the kind of tortured ambivalence of the British military. He was a very decent man, and the irony is he was not only the military commander, he was the royal governor. He did not have martial law while he's there, and so he is respecting the English liberties of the patriot leaders. And this means that as he's there, weapons, gunpowder are leaving Boston and going out into the country towns, manning those militia that he will be ultimately fighting against, and there's nothing he can do about it. And I think that's underappreciated. The fact that we were able to pull off a revolution happened in large part because someone like Gage was respectful of our liberties. And, so it was a complicated situation.
Well, I noticed you use several words. I mean, the word patriot, of course, is the one that pro-Americans we use to describe those people fighting the British. You also use the word militiamen, provincials. I mean, I guess it depends on which side you're on, but also all those words mean something.
Right. They are all freighted with meaning. And Massachusetts was technically not a colony. It was a province because there had been a royal governor appointed by the king. And so they were what we would call patriots, called themselves the Provincial Congress. And they had the provincial army. And what's interesting is, even at this late stage, at Bunker Hill, the patriots proclaim that they are still loyal to King George. It is the Parliament that they're against. And the British soldiers are saying, are you crazy? How can you be, against? That's too fine a distinction. But no, the patriots, they weren't fighting for independence at the beginning. They were fighting so that they could have representation when it came to issues of taxation. And they clung to the illusion that King George was still with them when that was not the case. But it was so hard for them to contemplate the possibility of independence. No one wanted that to happen.
Even as the battles, the skirmishes, you've got Lexington, you've got Concord, and then it works its way inexorably to Bunker Hill. I mean, over time, was the idea of independence more resonant?
What's interesting is you have the arrival of George Washington 10 days after Bunker Hill. At this time, the provincial army is still flying the English flag, which is symbolic of union to them. But as early as the fall of 1775, there are diary accounts of dinners where generals will no longer give a toast to the king, and they're talking about independence, really for the first time. In January 1st, a flag is raised. It's still the English flag, but you get the publication of Tom Paine's, pamphlet that will change everything, where common sense, hey, face this. We've taken it this far. The natural next step is, and it's not been in our dictionary up until now, but it's independence. We've got to make that step or, we're kidding ourselves. And King George adds fuel to that fire, and he says, look, you can't pretend to be loyal to me. This is war.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Nathaniel Philbrick is our guest today on the show, and we're talking about his new book. It's called Bunker Hill, and it's subtitled A City, A Siege, A Revolution. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. PAFA Continuing Education offers art classes for all ages and levels of experience this summer, including landscape, watercolor, portrait painting, and more. Featuring pre-college drawing and painting for high school students, the Summer Academy for teachers, and weekend masterclasses with renowned artists, including Stuart Shills and classical realist Juliet Aristides. Classes begin May 28th. Details online at pafa.edu/ce.
When it comes to writing personal lyrics, Kevin Parker of Tame Impala has a novel strategy.
Pretty self-conscious when it comes to writing lyrics, so I kind of just pretend that it's someone else, and that kind of gets me to the other side.
Tune in for the explosive psychedelic rock of Tame Impala this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Big Easy is known for its rich culinary traditions, but you might be surprised to learn that getting fresh food from the grocery store has been anything but easy for some people there. So New Orleans native actor Wendell Pierce decided to do something about it. We'll tell you what next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you're just joining us, Nathaniel Philbrick is our guest. He's a national award-winning author of narrative history, the author of a number of books, including Why Read Moby Dick, The Last Stand, Mayflower, Sea of Glory. And again, his new book is called Bunker Hill and subtitled A City, A Siege, A Revolution. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So did Thomas Gage just want to kind of sort of settle things down? I mean, that he was, as you write, he wanted to honor the civil liberties of the patriots, but they did not return the favor. That's one of the things that you write in this
book.
Yeah,
and he was put in an impossible situation. It was his job to impose what was the Boston Port Act, shutting down Boston commercially, which was Britain's overreaction to the Boston Tea Party. And then there was the passage of another intolerable act, as they were called, which was the Massachusetts Government Act, which basically shut down the charter, the way the state, the colony was governed. And this inflamed the entire colony, and there were royal officials were being mobbed, forced to flee to Boston. And he was quickly realizing he was losing complete control of the situation.
So how much of the considerations, I'm thinking about John Hancock, whom you write about, of course, a very important person in the early days of this country, that he had commercial considerations. I mean, that was sort of, he was a businessman.
Right. Well, you know, and the Tea Party was not just an ideological kind of, you know, taxation without representation. There were many merchants who smuggled illegal tea into Massachusetts, and the British were actually offering tea at a cheaper rate that undercut the smuggled tea. And so many merchants, like John Hancock, objected to this because it was going to be money out of their pocket. And so, you know, it's like life today. It's easy to say this is a matter of you know, higher concerns, when actually there's other very immediate concerns that are influencing what people believe.
I have to say, as I was reading your book, I was transported back to first or second or third grade reading a book about Johnny Tremaine.
Oh my goodness, Johnny Tremaine.
I remember that so vividly for
Esther
some reason.
Esther Forbes, I read that in fifth grade. And
I probably read it in fifth grade too.
Well,
I wasn't that smart.
So no, it's just, and the Disney, I think, did a movie of it. It's great. It's got all the characters. Actually, Joseph Warren is in it.
Huh?
Not that I remembered Joseph Warren from that, but for me, that was the first book where I could understand that it was kids like me were part of history, and that it was ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, not these marble statues, you know, wandering through dusty dates.
But as you also say, a number of these groups, the Sons of Liberty and others, that there was a vigilante part of what they were doing.
Right. The first chapter of my book, I describe what was the most brutal tar and feathering in all of New England, when a customs inspector, John Malcolm, who was from Boston, and this guy was not a likable person at all. He created a lot of his own issues. But on the coldest night of January, he was dragged from his house, stripped of his clothing, hot tar poured on his skin, smeared with feathers from a down pillow, and basically beaten and dragged around the town for 5 hours, rolled back from a cart into his house. He would be in his bed for 6 weeks. The flesh would peel off his back in what were described as stakes, but he would live. And it was this kind of vigilante justice where the patriot leaders didn't want it to happen, and yet things were boiling over. It was just that much of a cauldron. And so these kinds of things were happening. There was a vigilante element that was part of this whole patriot movement that had little respect for personal liberties.
But, one thinks of occupation, that there's something so shameful and shaming about being occupied.
Exactly.
Think?
And, you know, I think, and then on the other side, you can have some sympathy for the army that is occupying. These soldiers did not want this duty. They were just trying to keep the lid on. But they were resented by these people, quite understandably so. And so violence was breaking out all around. And Thomas Gage was the one who was trying to keep things from exploding, and but eventually it was going to happen.
So what was, I mean, perhaps there were several sparks that led to the Battle of Bunker Hill.
There were, and it was, it's amazing how early it began, in September of 1774. So we're talking, you know, almost 9 months before it all happens. By this time, it's clear things could get really bad. And everyone knows that gunpowder will be the key to it, because no one's making gunpowder in the colonies. It all comes from Great Britain. And if it goes south, they ain't going to be providing gunpowder. And so all the towns start rounding up their own powder, and Gage starts rounding up his powder. And this leads inevitably to increasing tensions.
Let me get to a caller in to speak to that very issue. We've got, looks like, Alan from Bath, Pennsylvania, joining us on Radio Times. Alan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're
and that
welcome.
Is precisely where the point that I was getting. Was Thomas, first thing, was Thomas Gage the commander and governor who gave the order to go out and confiscate the powder? And was that the initial disarmament that really got things going?
You know, that is a great question, and I think you've really put your finger on what alerted everyone to the fact that this was a very, very dangerous position. And it wasn't just Boston that was the seat of defiance. All of those towns around were also ready to contribute to the building tensions. What was happened in by the end of August, it was, as I referred to earlier, it was becoming a game of everyone wanted to round up the powder. And Gage, at the end of that month, ordered about 300 British regulars to get the powder that was stored in the Royal in a powder house in modern Somerville, just off the Mystic River. The operation went on without a hitch. They got the powder in the early morning hours, brought it back, but there was a rumor that was flying around New England that Patriot militiamen opposed them. Shots were fired, and four people were killed. Hmm. It didn't happen, but the rumor went out like wildfire. By that night, every town within a 50-mile radius of Boston was inflamed. Their militia, and each town had its own militia, and these were farmers and artisans who had trained on a regular basis, had muskets. That by the early morning, they were all marching to Cambridge to defend their brethren. Hmm. By the middle of the next day, there were 4,000 armed Patriot militiamen, three times the population of Cambridge, gathered on the common. They quickly learned that it was a false rumor, but they began to take care of business. They began to insist that all royal officials renounce their appointments. It was getting tense. It was getting tense. And this is when Joseph Warren makes his first appearance. He calms it down. But suddenly, Gage realized, man, it's not just Boston. Every town is in this, and those people have muskets.
Alan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Makes you wonder whether that's where the Second Amendment came from, a well-armed militia, you know, comma.
Well, you know, I think what, you know, everything has an historical context. And in New England, every town had a militia because there had been Indian wars since the early 17th century. And King Philip's War had been fought in 1675-76, exactly 100 years before all this, in which a third of the towns had been burned. There were towns in Maine, which was then part of Massachusetts, that had been attacked as recently as 16 years before. And so everyone, this was a living part of their tradition. And so that's why they had it. And it also meant, you know, you can organize, but unless you have a military at your command, it's hard to pull off a revolution. And that was the difference in New England.
And that's our guest, Nathaniel Philbrick. We're talking about his new book. It's titled Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. As we march through this piece of history, Alan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-WHYY. So we know it is Bunker Hill, but it's actually, as you said, it's really Breed Hill. Did they just confuse their hills as they were?
Yeah,
as they were
well,
since...
You know, the problem was by June of 1775, we've had Lexington and Concord. And so tension in the 60 days that follow that, more and more British soldiers are arriving in Boston. Boston is now besieged. It's surrounded by thousands of militiamen that are based in Cambridge and Roxbury. right next to the neck that goes into Boston. And the British are under pressure to break out, to try a knockout punch that will send this army of provincial soldiers reeling and snuff this out. And so the Patriots get word that the British are about to do this. And so in an attempt to delay it, the order is made to build an earthen redoubt on Bunker Hill, which mm-hmm. is on the Charlestown Peninsula. Mm-hmm. Charlestown Peninsula heads south to within a quarter mile of Boston, where Boston Harbor is just between it. And Bunker Hill was about a half mile away. And putting a fort there would have been a smart move. It would have prevented the British from attacking Cambridge quickly, but it wouldn't have started anything. For reasons that we will never know,
truly,
that night, Colonel William Prescott and his men, about 1,000 men, spend the night building a fort, not on Bunker Hill, but on Breed's Hill, which is right in the figurative face of the British. Dawn comes, and they see that they are surrounded by British warships, all cannon-equipped. Boston, a half mile away, cannons everywhere, bristling, all pointed at them. The cannonballs start firing. And Gage looks and says, I've got to attack this. I can't just let this outrageous act go without a response. And so he tells his subordinate, General William Howe, to lead more than 2,000 British regulars to take this. And this drives the Patriot leadership, wait a minute, we were trying to stop this. And so it was disorganized from the beginning. There's an element of confusion that started it and will forever be attached to it.
So an accident, in a sense, was the spark for the American Revolution.
Yes.
I mean, probably something else would have sparked it at some other later
right.
date or time or place.
Yes, this was a fire just waiting for the match to be lit. And, you know, what this did was exactly what many Patriot leaders wanted, that, you know, hey, this, we need to do something here. Something has to happen. And you wonder, one of the Prescott may have had an underlying motive in doing this. And what happened was the bloodiest battle mm-hmm. of the Revolution. The British would eventually take this fort, but it would cost them casualties of almost 50%, which is just terrible.
In fact, you describe over what appears to be a several hour period, just the carnage from this battle.
Yeah, the carnage. And, you know, what made this a different kind of battle was it was almost a spectator event. There were thousands of Bostonians on their roofs watching. It was just happening right there. It was a sunny, summer-like day. 2,000 British regulars and their glittering regalia marching up this green hill towards the Patriot lines that extended from this fort all the way across the width of Charlestown Peninsula to the Mystic River. You have these cannons being fired from all these surrounding ships. It was horrifying, and people could watch it. You know, it's sort of like how we watch some of these terrible things on mm-hmm. TV today. For the 18th century, this was truly extraordinary to have this all happening right before them. And we have this one account from John Burgoyne, a British general who was stationed on Copp's Hill, in Boston during this, and he describes the tension they're all feeling, knowing that what was about to transpire could literally change the course of history in the English-speaking world.
And on one side, I'm imagining the British military probably well-organized, well-armed, you know, had a battle plan. I mean, they were, I guess, used to being a member of the military. Then you have this more sort of DIY, do-it-yourself group on the other side trying to hold off the British.
It's a really fascinating study in contrast. You're right. This is one of the best-trained British Army in the world. And with that goes a certain amount of arrogance. What are a group of farmers going to do when they see 2,000 soldiers not only with muskets but with 17-inch bayonets attached to them? Most of the Patriots did not have bayonets, and when it came to this kind of close battle, between a pitched battle between armies, inevitably came down to bayonet charges.
Which means close range, obviously.
Close range, and you fire once, and in the smoke, you run and attack and bayonet your opponent. And they kind of assumed the provincials, when faced with this, would run. But what you also see is Prescott created this huge problem by building this fort. But then as other generals, other officers arrive, instead of throwing up their hands, they begin to do the best they can to improvise a solution. Mm-hmm. And so you have someone saying, okay, let's extend a breastworks here. And then another guy says, I'll build a rail fence here. And then finally, Colonel John Stark, this grizzled guy from New Hampshire, realizes, oh my gosh, they could just come along the beach, get behind us, and attack us from behind. I'll put a stone wall. And that's what really saved the day. Because that's exactly what William Howe was going to do. He had a perfect plan drawn up. You know, he'd sneak a group of his crack troops along the beach and get them from the side. But thanks to Stark, who arrived at the last minute, instead of a wide-open back door, they met a stone wall, and more than 100 light infantry, British light infantry, died in just a matter of seconds.
Trying to storm it.
And everyone, these British had, many of them were very experienced, had been fighting the Seven-Year War in North America and in Europe, and all of them after the battle said they had never experienced as hot a fire as they had experienced at Bunker Hill.
And did someone say, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes?
It's interesting. There's no we don't have direct evidence. We know someone said, don't fire until you see the whites of the British half-gaiters. That doesn't quite have the same ring.
Someone actually said that?
Yes, yes. But the point is, that was what they were doing. They didn't have much powder, and so they knew what powder they had to make work. And so they waited until the British regulars were within 30 yards and then unleashed, and with horrifying results.
But as you said, the British won. I mean, they lost possibly as many as half of their soldiers, but they won this battle, the Battle of Bunker Hill.
They won. And as Howe, and you got to give Howe, he was a leader who at this time, you didn't lead back there, you know, in the back and say, you go there, you go there. He was with his men on all three charges. He had his entire staff either killed or wounded. At one point, both sides saw him standing alone right beside the Patriot line, you know, on the second charge. Third charge, they succeed. But as he would say, this is success was too dearly bought. And everyone realized after the Battle of Bunker Hill, this is not a few skirmishes that can be negotiated away. We are now out in for a real war.
And how many did the militia or the Patriots lose in this battle?
They lost more than 100 men. And, you know, and they were actually had very few casualties until it came to the retreat. And that's when they began to lose people because they ran out of gunpowder. And that's what the British could not believe. They could not believe that these men stayed in that redoubt until the British were actually coming over the wall and with a sword in one hand and a bayonet-equipped musket in the other. And that's when Joseph Warren died. And usually a opposing army is running well before the coming over the walls, but not in this case. And so that's when people died and were eventually flushed out of the Charlestown Peninsula. But as Nathaniel Green from Rhode Island would write soon after, if we could sell the British another hill like Bunker Hill, we'd be happy to.
Well, let me pick up on our conversation after this very short break. And again, Nathaniel Philbrick is our guest today on Radio Times, and he's got a new book. It's called Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. After this short break, George Washington's first impression of these militiamen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University Graduate Studies, offering over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in arts and sciences, business, the arts, education, and health sciences. For more information or to submit an application online, wcupa.edu/grad. Westchester University. Learn more. Westchester University proudly supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Caro talks about the fourth volume of his biography of Lyndon Johnson, covering the years 1958 to 1964. He describes the animosity between Johnson and Robert Kennedy this way.
Did you ever see two strange dogs come into a room, and all of a sudden they growl and the hair rises on the back of the neck?
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Thank you. Odds that a couple will celebrate their 20th wedding anniversary is about 50-50. Not very good news for young couples ready to say I do in this season of spring nuptials. While education, compatibility, stress, and money can pull marriages apart, some marriages are strengthened as issues are negotiated. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, Divorce Prevention 101. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. I almost forgot who I was. I'm Marty Moscoe. Looking at some other names here that we all associate with the American Revolution, John Adams, Sam Adams, John Hancock. How about the name Joseph Warren? He played an important role in the 1770s, pivotal events leading up to the Battle of Bunker Hill. Turned out to be the bloodiest battle in that war. And our guest Nathaniel Philbrick has restored Joseph Warren's rightful place in history in his new book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. So a young George Washington makes his way up to Boston, this area. What is he essentially hired to do, I guess, if I can use that phrase?
Yeah, he has just been appointed by the Continental Congress, basically right as Bunker Hill is unfolding. And, of course, they have no idea that's unfolding. But he arrives about 10 days after the battle and is not pleased with what he finds. You know, this
at
is,
all.
At all. He describes them as a dirty, nasty group of people. And what he was encountering was he was coming from Virginia, which is was a very hierarchical society where class mattered. Going to New England, where people went to town meetings, and instead of being told what to do, they talked about it. Consensus was how they were used to doing things. And it was described as a level society by some people who came away from it. And, you know, they would, so this group of very dirty provincial soldiers, if their officer said, well, this is what we're going to do, they said, no, wait a minute. We have to talk about this first. And so discipline was something they were allergic to. And Washington is responsible for turning this group of soldiers into an army.
Well, in fact, he also says he remarks about the stupidity in the lower class of these people, kind of underscoring this whole class division.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what he couldn't believe was the officers at one point, he says, are of the same kidney as the soldiers. That, you know, you could not tell the difference, you know, by how they dressed. They're all just slobs. And, you know, so it was, and I, for me, the appearance of Washington is really the beginning when these 13 colonies are being dragged kicking and screaming into becoming a one nation. Mm-hmm. Because you see these colonies that were not used to working together. Mostly they were arguing with one another. Now they have to work together. And Washington is the one who immediately goes, oh my gosh, this is what I have to work with. But then he takes a deep breath and he starts to work with it. And he, you know, but he is a different Washington from the guy that stares at us from the dollar bill. He was not yet a stoic icon, you know. He was in his early 40s, he was passionate. He had did a good job of controlling his emotions, but clearly, you know, he had a very emotional response to this army, and he wanted to attack the British. He really did. But the Continental Congress had made it clear that before he could do anything of that with that much moment, he had to consult his Council of War of about half a dozen generals and had to get their consent. And what they realized, they didn't have enough gunpowder. These men were a long way from being properly organized. And if they had attacked the British, who were entrenched in Boston, it would have been a bloodbath, and it would have consigned Boston to the flames. But from Washington's point of view, he's, you know, we can't just sit here. It's expensive to maintain an army. When will we always have this option? We've got them right here. Let's go for it. And I think he knew he would be undercut by his Council of War, but he's always pushing, always pushing. And he was adding a new element of vitality that the provincial army had never seen before.
And how much do you think the fact that he looked so good on a horse? I mean, did that help him be seen as a leader?
Absolutely. As you see in people's diaries accounts, where just saw George Washington. Oh, my gosh. You know, he really looks like a general. And, you know, and Washington knew this. You know, he had spent the last months at the Continental Congress, the only one dressed in a military uniform. Was that sort of a subtle hint that maybe he should lead the military?
Right.
You know, this was a man like Joseph Warren before him, who was a very different leader. Joseph Warren was passionate and not terribly organized. Washington did the best he could to control his passions, was highly organized, but he did have the outward trappings that said, I am a leader.
You also described these early on organized or semi-organized militias, poorly organized and possibly alcohol debilitated. The idea that people drank a lot in those days.
Right. Well, you know, it was just the way it was. And one, we have an account which was from a British officer, so you cannot necessarily trust him. He was a surgeon who went behind the lines during that summer to treat some British soldiers. And he could not believe how much these guys were drinking. He claimed, whether it's true or not, that, you know, each soldier had to have an entire bottle of rum a day.
Whoa.
You know, once again, you have to the source, but it was, you know, it was a part of the culture. It really was. And this was an army that was not used to being what we think of as an army, to be, you know, having hierarchical discipline and this kind of thing. They were militiamen. They would only serve with people they knew, family members, neighbors. They did not trust someone they didn't know. And that's the challenge Washington had. New England was a very tribal kind of community.
And very different from Virginia or the other parts of the country that he was used to.
Yes, and you know, and it meant for a real clash of cultures, and it was not easy. It was not pretty. It was not fun. But you know, Washington was one of the few people with the ability to just hang in there and command by example, and he would see it through.
Well, we're getting a bit of a history lesson with our guest, Nathaniel Philbrick, today on Radio Times. Again, author of this new book called Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Mike from Bethlehem to join us. And Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well,
go ahead.
There's a debate here, local debate among friends that Paul Revere did not ride through the countryside notifying the outlying areas that the British were coming, that it was his apprentice, John Dawes, who did that. And he had just loaned John Dawes his horse and told him to go and notify the countryside. And the reason why that Revere seemed to come down with the authority that he ran through the countryside himself was attributed to a Longfellow's poem.
Well, Mike, you called the right place. Go ahead.
Right. Well, you know, you put your finger on a lot of what makes up history and popular perceptions of it. Yes, we've all heard of Paul Revere thanks to Longfellow's famous poem. Revere's story was not central to the story until that, but it has remained ever since. Yes, Revere did alert the countryside that the British were headed to Concord, but Dawes did as well. But what we don't know is who gave those guys the order. Hmm. It was Joseph Warren. He was the last British patriot leader in Boston on April 8th, the night of April 18th. Everyone else had left, either fleeing for their lives or on their way to the Continental Congress. He was there, and he was the one who pressed the button, basically, that unleashed what would become the revolution by ordering Dawes and Revere to send out the message. And what's interesting is that the provincial Congress had come up with a very, very laid out list of things that had to happen before you could put out that order. And one of them was that if the British soldiers were heading out, they'd had to have baggage and artillery with them to set that alarm. And they didn't have that because they knew of that law. And yet Warren went ahead and pushed the button. And so you could argue that Warren took some liberties when it came to beginning the revolution. You know, and it's one of those things, I think like most things that happen in very tumultuous times, you don't know how much of it is calculated, how much of it is accident, But he did. He was one of these guys who thrived in times when many people just either shut down or are overwhelmed. He could operate under these circumstances, and he was calling the shots.
Mike, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, you can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. I'm assuming people in Boston know about Joseph Warren or know more about Joseph Warren than those of us down here in Philadelphia.
Well, I wish that were true.
Really?
Yes, there are more. Joseph Warren, younger brother, for example, John Warren, would found Mass General Hospital. They were quite a family. But no, there is not a statue for him in Boston. In fact, there's now kind of a movement brewing that there should be, because the location of his house in Boston is very near the perfect place for a statue. He is not a household word, even though there are many towns and streets named for him. People don't even know who that, why it's called Warren. And, this is, what happens in history when a life is cut short and, the paper trail isn't left for historians. And the other thing is, when Warren leaves, who shows up? Washington, who, of course, is the man that will lead this for the 8 years of the American Revolution. And I don't think it's that surprising that Joseph Warren, even though he was the one who basically provided an army for Washington to then turn into the Continental Army, his story has been lost.
I was reading some of the reviews of your book, and someone was trying to make some parallels between, I guess, today's revolutions and the American Revolution, and even making the comparison between Dawes and Revere as they send the word out, that those were the kind of social networks, that we saw, for instance, in the Arab Spring, the idea that you could use word of mouth to spread the word about an upcoming battle or event.
Well, yeah, and this was recognized by the Patriot leaders. As early as 1772, Samuel Adams had created the Boston Committee of Correspondence, and this was a system by which a 21-member committee in Boston would write open letters that were then read in all the town meetings of the 250 towns in Massachusetts. And suddenly he changed everything. He was turning these town meetings, where usually they talked about road maintenance and things like that.
Someone's cow, perhaps.
Right. Turning them into chat rooms about the issues of the day. And so as events began to accelerate and eventually led to the Boston Tea Party, it was the committees of correspondence that were sending messages back and forth that knit it together. And it was, very similar to what happened in the Middle East. Different technology, obviously, but it was communication was the key. And that's why Paul Revere was essential, because as things began to bubble over, the Patriots were the ones who were able to get the message out the quickest, because they had people, riders.
They had a system, right?
They had the system in place. They knew the roads. The British, hemmed in Boston, there was no way. And then the other thing that affected communication was the Atlantic. 3,000 miles of ocean between the colonies and London. If Gage was going to do anything with the consent of the British ministry, he had to send a letter across the ocean, which took a month. They had to think about it, talk to the Parliament, took another month. Then it took another month to come back, 3 months. By that time, events had, gone out of control. And so I think once things were going bad between America and England, the Atlantic made sure that they were going to go from bad to worse.
Let me get another caller. And looks like we have Tom from Dresher joining us on Radio Times. And Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm a retired military officer, and command and control is a real important thing when leading a military. My understanding was at this time, everything was pretty loosey goosey as far as the colonials go. Yet they're facing a unified command structure on the other side. How were decisions made on the colonial side among the various colonial militias?
Tom, thanks for the call.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And that's where, once again, the Provincial Congress had what was known as the Committee of Safety. And this was basically the executive body of the revolution's government. And Joseph Warren was a leading personage there. And they were the ones who were creating the system of riders that would get to the other towns and spread the word. And Revere was just one example of this network. And so as tensions were building towards Lexington and Concord, there was a constant series of communications going out to towns. And then there were towns that would become like the center of their specific region. Worcester, for example, which is to the north and west of Boston, became a real epicenter of the military in that area. And so it became, you could argue that it was that system of communication that made Lexington and Concord happen, because as soon as word came out, thousands of militiamen appeared on the road on from Concord back to Boston. And so even it took them a few hours to get there. The British got to Concord and confiscated some armaments and things, but it really didn't amount to much. But as they marched back, they were just thousands of militiamen were appearing. And they weren't highly organized, but just the sheer number of them meant that they made lives terrible for those soldiers that were, it was just a firefight all the way back. And it was communication that really gave the militiamen in the beginning the ability to appear in, an almost, if not a minute, pretty close to it.
Tom, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're nearly out of time here, but you learned that Ben Affleck has actually, optioned your book.
Yeah, with Warner Brothers. I think there's no one in Hollywood right now who knows Boston better, and the movie The Town is actually set largely
in the Bunker Hill area.
Obviously, this is a different point of time, but I find it's quite intriguing. We'll see where it goes.
And we're almost out of time here, but Ron Howard is making a movie of another one of your books.
Yes, In the Heart of the Sea, about a whale ship that was rammed by a whale and inspired Moby Dick. Apparently has gotten the green light and may become a movie, it looks like.
Well, lucky you. And Nathaniel Philbrick, thank you very much for joining us today, Radio Times. Really a fascinating story.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. Nathaniel Philbrick, again, our guest today on Radio Times. The book is called Bunker Hill, subtitled A City, A Siege, A Revolution. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out about our Facebook page and Twitter, the archives, podcasts, email, and satellite radio as well. Bob Alls, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Susan Green, Bomb, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.